and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am an editor-at-large at the journal Ad Fontes, and I'm joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor at Ad Fontes, and Reese Laverty, senior editor of the whole operation. Gentlemen, it's good to be here with you.
You hear that, everyone? It's back to always.
Back to always. I'm just going to mix it up from now on.
Negging works. Host.
It's my right.
That's what he thinks. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Always, most of the time. Actually, that's what Aristotle says at the beginning of the Physics. Always or most of the time. So, you know,
I'm just
being a good Aristotelian.
That's a big qualification to make.
Yeah, that's right. I know, it is actually a big qualification. Anyway, it's kind of funny, actually, that his whole physics is built on always or most of the time.
Most of
but
the
anyway,
time.
All right, we are here not to talk about Aristotle's physics, but about Oliver O'Donovan's Begotten or Made. We are in the second chapter. On page 27
of the Davenant Press edition.
We are flying of the Davenant Press edition. That's right. We're flying through this book now. Last time we covered like five pages. Much better than previous times. So Reese, can you please review the last, I don't know, five pages for us so we can get up to speed on where we are, and then we'll kind of kick it from there.
Sure thing. So yeah, Begotten or Made, O'Donovan's lectures given initially in the wake of a report on IVF in the early days of Margaret Thatcher's government administration, went through the first chapter on the modern revolution in an understanding of freedom and how that affects medicine. And then chapter two, Sex by Artifice. He begins in what he acknowledges might seem like a bit of a kind of sidetrack from his topic of IVF. He begins to talk about what then would have been called transsexualism, now we might call transgenderism. But O'Donovan says that there are some significant reasons why he devotes a whole chapter to this. He has this question on page 19. The great intellectual challenge that faces our age with these innovations is not to understand that this is being done, but to understand what it is. And he's going to use this inquiry in this chapter eventually to come back round, go back to his main topic of IVF, but to say when this thing that he calls transsexualism happens, when we intervene medically in that situation, what is it that's being done? He talks about the givenness of the man-woman relationship, why that's good for both men and women and for the children who are the natural fruit of that relationship. And he then begins to talk about some of the after effects of the reality of transsexualism. He says that when sex difference is something that can be changed, it begins to be seen as artificial. So people who remain in their sex are seen as remaining there by choice, not just receiving and being what they were given and what God made them as. And then sex itself reduces to play because it becomes an area where human artifice and technique can be very much deployed. And then as he begins to move more into transsexualism kind of proper, he gives a bit of an overview, it's kind of page 24, 25 of our edition, of the kind of lay of the land of what transsexualism is and was at that point. And then he comes back to this question in the middle of page 26, we need to understand what is it that is being done and why. And then he says that there are two quite distinguishable answers given to that question by those who advocate and practice techniques of transsexual surgery. One answer says it resolves an ambiguity, and then further down, the other answer is that surgery creates a framework of pretense, and he refers to these respectively as the psychological case of transsexualism and the social case of transsexualism. So that's kind of where we've got up to, and the rest of our discussion is going to be him going through those two instances, those two responses, and what they reveal about what we think is happening in transsexualism and responses to it, the psychological case and the social case. Yes.
Thanks for that, Reese. Yeah, so I think we're going to just start with the psychological case and keep moving, if that sounds good to people. It was interesting because in rereading the psychological case, I mean, we've been talking a lot about how prescient so much of like O'Donovan's writing is and how he was seeing this stuff in the 80s. And the psychological case, I think, may actually be familiar to some of our listeners just from hearing how these matters are discussed today, because I think we kind of have decided for the psychological case option, societally speaking or something. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that, and we'll find out as we kind of move through it. But just to kind of familiarize, you know, so that listeners can kind of have a, when he talks about psychological case and social case, it can seem kind of abstract, but I think that the I don't know, having a sort of way to kind of map this onto the way that these things are discussed could be helpful.
So the psychological case, you know, right. my understanding is O'Donovan's here saying he's going to, in these two cases, he's going to lay out what he thinks is sort of, if not the same, very similar phenomenon being understood from two different perspectives.
Right, that, psychologically or socially.
That's right.
That's what I took, yeah.
And so, you know, you have to take the phenomenon, he says, let's speak of a female to male transsexual. So what he means by that, because he's trying to be very clear, he's trying to be very technical, and actually he cites, for those of you who are not reading along, which you should be, there's another paper that Oliver O'Donovan has written, because he's Oliver O'Donovan, so he's written a paper on everything, called Transsexualism and Christian Marriage, published by London Groves. I actually haven't read that personally. Anyone on here? No?
Yeah. I've got it on the shelf.
Reese has got it on the shelf. He'll perhaps go to it for further reference. But he says, we want to talk about somebody with XX chromosomes, female gonads, genitalia perfectly congruent. And hereby, I think part of why O'Donovan's saying that is he's recognizing there are other cases, right? You've got people with XYX or XX, you know, XYY. There's various, what we would call very clear biological anomalies, which is, you know, sometimes referred to as intersex or something. He's not trying to discuss that.
He's bracketing all of that and saying, let's take a case where you have complete, like, biological clarity about, you know, what sex a person is.
Right. And he says, but this individual's gender identity does not accord with her body.
And he actually uses that terminology, gender identity, which was gobsmacked to see that. But it's because he's dealing with academic literature, and this has now sort of become mainstream in the intervening period.
Right. And I think one of his valuable insights here, just in the first opening, is he says that the idea that she has, therefore, an ambiguous sex is a major philosophical decision. So in other words, there is an act of interpretation, which is what he's really trying to talk about in this whole section, right? And that's what Reese referred to, is the what is it that's happening? He's trying to give us an interpretation. He's trying to help us become aware of the interpretations of reality that we're all making as we walk around, and then help us hopefully attune those so that we can see it more clearly. And he says, if you begin with the presumption that the female-to-male transsexual who has, you know, all the biology is female and yet decides to say, my gender identity doesn't accord with my body, therefore I'm going to, you know, do something about that to make conformity or to fit the one with the other, you've made a philosophical decision of interpretation already.
And then he's going to explain, I think, the nature of that philosophical position. So he starts, I think he says that in making this, we've collapsed the distinction between physical sex and psychological sex, or sex and gender. Physical sex is sex, psychological sex is gender. And then we have denied that the biological elements of her sexuality can comprise an unambiguous totality, which can be set against and contrasted with her problematic psychology. Her sex is understood as an undifferentiated psychosomatic whole, a whole which displays ambiguities.
So he's already sort of implying.
Can you guys make sense of that?
Yeah, I think what he's doing is he's saying that by positing a problem with alignment between somebody's inner experience of being themselves in their body and their sense of comfort with it and this kind of thing, by not being able to make the distinction between that and the body as body functioning in the way that the body, you know, if we were to sort of look at an animal, we would say that's an animal with a healthy body. The body's functioning fine. By not making that distinction, by conflating the two, you're sort of intruding upon and making presumptions about the one which might only be true of the other. And I don't know if that actually clarifies it, but that's the way that it made sense to me.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, so as he continues, he basically says that if you think that her sex is an undifferentiated psychosomatic whole, then the sex gender development, her sort of process of sex and gender development is no longer understood as two processes where mm-hmm. you have the biological development and the psychological development, but rather as a single undivided process, which begins with XX chromosomes and ends in a consciousness in this case of unhappiness with her sex. And then this is the key line, I think, but within this undifferentiated process, social conditioning has played a part. So he says, okay, you have the biology and the psychology. If you don't treat these as distinct, if you treat them, if you make this move and you don't treat them as distinct, then you have an undifferentiated whole, a biology psychology sort of combination. And so the biology psychology unity develops together. And one of the ways that it develops is into unhappiness with the current state of affairs, right? Does that make sense? But then what's key is that social conditioning has played a part in the development of this gender sex unity, right?
So I think that means that it's beginning from a position where nature is ruled out and social conditioning is the primary, maybe the only process that's admitted.
I think we get there. I don't know that he's said that yet, but I think that's where he's going. Yeah.
I'm just running the logic, you know, implicitly in my head.
Yeah. I think his point is that because, you know, on a different model, for example, where you treat the biology and the psychology as distinct, you could say that social conditioning played a part in the development of the psychology, mm-hmm. but not the biology, right? So, so you have a perfectly healthy, sexually functioning body. Psychologically, you're unhappy with it, and social conditioning played a part in that. But he's saying, look, if you reject that distinction, then social conditioning is playing a part in determining the entire...
It intrudes into the body. The bodily space, the natural space, we would want to call. Yeah.
Right. Does that sound right to you guys? Yeah.
Well, what does that mean, though? Because this oddly feels like a sort of anticipating Judith Butler by about 10 years.
I think no, I actually think that that's exactly what's happening. Because as he continues the example, it actually becomes clear that he, let's see here. So within this undifferentiated process, social conditioning played a part. She was assigned, in quotes, he puts that in quotes, she was assigned to the female sex at birth and treated as a girl thereafter, and this helped to determine the development of her psychosexuality unpredictably as it happened. And it's unpredictably because even though she was assigned female at mm-hmm. birth and treated like a girl, she doesn't feel like it, right? I think that's what he's saying. And then he said, but this is, so I, yeah, so this is, I'll just read the next thing and then we can talk about it because mm-hmm. I think, this is one of those cases where when something is unclear, maybe it just helps to keep reading. So I don't know, but if you guys have a different way of,
this is one of these where I was like, this is pointless me underlining this section because I'm just going to underline the whole thing.
So then he says, now if we respond to the ambiguous outcome of this total process, so the psychosexual process of development and the social dissatisfaction with it, if we respond to the ambiguous outcome of this total process by surgically, quote unquote, reassigning her to the male sex, we are apparently not intruding or introducing any new influences upon this determination of her sex that were not already operative in the process anyway. Nature, nurture, and artifice have become indistinguishable elements in an undifferentiated process of necessity. So I think what he's saying there is that if you treat the psychosexual development as a unity, and you grant that social factors have played a determining function, maybe not exclusive or decisive, but a determinative function in psychosexual development, then the decision to get a sex change surgery or something, I'm not entirely sure what exactly he has in view here.
Just say medical intervention.
Medical intervention, yeah. The decision to have a medical intervention
such that is you're actually reassigned. Just
a continuation of the entire process of development, Because even though that's a response to these factors of social conditioning, mm-hmm. those factors of social conditioning are themselves part of this process of development. And so the entire thing becomes a unity. Does that, Colin, you look like...
I mean, the question I have is, what's the necessity that he has in mind, whatever that is, 10 lines down, kind of towards the end of where you were reading on 28. And I think, you know, necessity is left ambiguous because he's implying more than he's saying. So if nature, nurture, and artifice have become indistinguishable elements in an undifferentiated process of necessity, if that's what he's saying, it's necessary because what it means for you to be a human in the world is to have some sort of sexual identity, and the necessity is being driven by your unhappiness, because happiness is the point of life. I think he is sort of pulling that in from the classical tradition, because it's the unhappiness that the person's experiencing with their sexual identity that is driving them to seek reassignment, since the unhappiness is given by the assignment in the first place. So the necessity that forces the social to again intrude upon the process is the end of human life, which is happiness.
I wasn't sure about that, just because the next sentence is he attributes the entire view that he's just explicated to the American sexual theorist John Money. And I wouldn't think
great
that
name.
Money has... Yeah. Leave it to an American to have the name John Money. But I guess I just wouldn't think that is what Money had in mind. And he seems to be attributing that position to Money.
Well, then it's bad writing.
Or maybe your interpretation is wrong.
We keep talking about everything's become a unity. I think,
or undifferentiated.
I've alluded to Judith Butler. If people have ever read Judith Butler, consider yourselves very lucky. But she, you know, is most famous for that kind of assertion that actually even our biological sex is constructed, and you just like that is just such an absurd.
Well, she thinks gender is most fundamental. Yeah, it's more fundamental than sex.
So most people, that's just like you get your head around what that means. But with what is what O'Donovan is saying here, that when we reject a kind of body soul distinction, reject hylomorphism. He's not used that word, so I'm not entirely sure if that's what he's saying.
I don't know that
he's talking about psychology and body.
Psychology.
Okay, so if the mind is just body, maybe, everything just kind of boils down to just a kind of melange of atoms and natural process, and so the doctor intervening to help you realize your gender identity is just not a different thing, because you're just atoms, you're just processes, you're just there to be redirected and shaped.
Yeah, I think so. The necessity language I took, and this I think touches on your question, Rhys. So the sentence afterwards, he said to the moral theologian, so to me basically, to Oliver O'Donovan.
That's a very Socratic move there, isn't it?
The most interesting feature of this conception is that there is apparently no point at which human decision supervenes upon natural process. To speak of decision and action implies that we stand back from the world and respond to it, whether sympathetically or unsympathetically, by the self-determination of our wills. On this account, however, it appears that the surgeon never acts in this sense, since the process of nature also embraces what he does.
Yeah.
His technical intervention is simply the most mature and developed work of the natural process. So I took that to be saying, like, what's so interesting is that we can't actually distinguish the will. Like, essentially, human action loses its distinctively moral characteristics. There is no will that makes decisions or reacts to things that are given, because everything that we are is socially, essentially socially determined. That, like, our mm-hmm. psychosexual unity is entirely a process of I mean, biology, nature, and society, but these things have all been sort of combined into a single process that forms us. And I think his point is that the surgeon in this instance is also a product of the single process that forms us. Mm-hmm. And so the surgeon's activities in response to someone who's dissatisfied with her psychosexual sort of unity is itself a function of necessity. It couldn't have been otherwise because it's been totally shaped by the combination of biological and social forces, which are not themselves distinguishable because we've reduced biology to assignment and then talked about sort of social. Does that make sense?
Well, so just trying to build on.
I have a take I'm so angry
and...
about that I will get to it. Go ahead.
Things he said earlier in the chapter, he says earlier, you can either receive your the male-female binary as a gift and welcome it, or you can resent it. And if there's no receiving of that as a given, and that as just being, slip in some philosophical categories here, if there's no being, then everything is just becoming. And so your the process of you kind of, you know, becoming and coming to terms with yourself, with your gender identity, let's say, that is in fact no different to the doctor than intervening and altering your body that you might realize that they're just variations of the same thing.
I thought that's what it was.
I'm going to keep pushing this happiness thing because I think it's what he's getting at, because it's the unhappiness that's driving the process. If you think of how you get happiness from the Aristotelian perspective, it has to do with an identification of natural capacities and energies and a conforming of oneself and one's habits and one's will and one's choice to the perfection and purification of those activities and energies. And so there's a sort of recognition of a natural basis that the will sort of comes up on top of. If you erase those distinctions, which is actually, I mean, I think that he's sort of also subtly saying that there's like a Heideggerian move that's going on here, because if you read like The Origin of the Work of Art, you know, Heidegger sort of elides the distinction between the traditional categories of techne and phusis, right? Nature and making. Mm-hmm. And so if you erase those distinctions, then the human making is just kind of the final act of the nature that you were given. And there's no need to sort of recognize the natural givenness of being that precedes the human doing. Because human doing is the end of human being. And the human doing to the human then is just another aspect of human doing. So you sort of mm-hmm. are, you become the work of art in a certain sense.
Right.
And
right.
that's,
right.
And so this doctor is sort of the final piece of the process of the natural process of sexual identification or maturity for the person who goes to this doctor.
Right. No, that all sounded absolutely right, except for the beginning part where you talked about Aristotle and happiness. For the rest of it was great. Once you hit Heidegger, I was like, yep, this sounds exactly right.
Okay, and then, sorry, a bit I did underline then to weave us back in. So near toward the bottom of 28, now, I think we've just clarified something of what O'Donovan's saying here. So thus, it might seem that we have to say exactly the opposite about this procedure conceived in this way to what we said about the general tendencies of technological society. Instead of treating nature as a special case of artifice, we treat artifice now as a special case of natural process.
I swear,
but what a natural process. It is evident that the dominant factor in it is society.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the key move, that the dominant factor is society. So this is why I think the most significant moments in the natural process of sex differentiation, which begins with the XX chromosome and ends now with the construction of artificial male genitalia, are those in which society assigns and reassigns the patient first to one sex and then to another. These are the only moments in the process that are conclusively determinative, and they're social moments. So the only determinative moments, the only crucial moments in the process of sex differentiation and development are social. It's, you know, doctors saying you are X, and it's doctors again saying you are Y. And they're not only social, they're medical, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, sorry, Reese, you have your hand.
Well, I just think that really then weaves together two big points he's made so far. In the first chapter, the definition of freedom and how that changes. We essentially now think of freedom as freedom from suffering. And then in chapter two, we said this in our recap, that once the option to change your sex exists, all sex is seen as elective.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that view of freedom and with that understanding of sex, then remaining in your sex is seen as a sort of an act of artifice. And there is no reason at all that it is an unnatural thing to intervene and to change that.
Yeah,
well, it's an act of artifice/nature/society, because these things are like indistinguishable somehow, right? So it's like,
it's almost like a confirmation process. I mean, to I don't know if this is, I'm going to probably be shot down for this, because, but it's not Aristotle. No, actually, so on the other hand, maybe
I think no, this shows promise. Colin,
so it's a. You know, like you sort of baptize as a kid, you're Christian, but then at a certain point, you're supposed to sort of like accept this. You're supposed to sort of confirm this. And
you
so
it, the grace of the Holy Spirit.
That's right. And so there's this kind of parallel process, which I think is presumed in the back. Again, I don't think O'Donovan is directly talking about this, but if you accept this way of thinking about sex and gender, then at a certain point, presuming you do not want to transition, you want to remain in the sex that you were assigned, you sort of accept it. You have some sort of moment where you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I was assigned male and I am a male. And so this is like the male to male transition, you know, that you see some people. I don't think anybody's sort of actively doing this, but I think there is a sort of a weird, like when you sort of, you can internalize this even if you disagree with it in a sense, and it can be quite dangerous to, you know, the way you think about yourself and your self-perception and your perception of you know, the world around you, even if you don't ever interact with or have a lot of exposure to trans people, which I just think is kind of fascinating. Like, in other words, I'm talking about, like, you know, male lumberjack bros or something.
Sorry, I just didn't have anything to say to that.
It's fine. So,
which is not that it was a bad thing to say, Colin. I just didn't have a ready response.
That's good. I need a lot of affirmation. So
you should not feel bad.
Oh, thanks, man. Wow. This is like a hug on the podcast.
All right. Moving on.
We're at 29.
Yeah, we just moved to 29. Well,
so I've got a bit underlined in red. If artifice is defended, it's near the top. If artifice is defended then as a manifestation of a natural process, this is only because the natural process in question is in truth sociological.
Mm-hmm.
Society has become the supreme natural phenomenon. Beneath the surface of this theory, the epistemological autonomy of the natural sciences has been undermined and replaced by a sociological epistemology, which gives priority to the interpretation of events to the social construction which is placed upon them. And this, I think, is not an untypical movement in modern thought. The natural sciences lose confidence in their ability to offer a description of natural reality in itself and turn to the social sciences to make good the lack. So that was dropping a bomb there. And that's one of those prescient comments as well that feels like it speaks to kind of, you know, dynamics that are often discussed today, that relationship between the natural and the social.
When this Reese, I think, gets to your point about Butler, right, where he's making the point that, like, if you adopt this, then it's social construction all the way down. And ultimately, that's Butler's position, right, that gender actually constructs biological sex. Gender as the social construction is somehow more fundamental than sex as the biological construct. That's probably not a fair gloss of Butler. It's been a while since I read her, but that's
well, and he doesn't really talk about this, but you do see many other theorists sort of explaining, and I'm sure O'Donovan does more fully in other places, you know, how did you get to the point where, you know, this is major understatement, this is not an untypical movement in modern thought, is the kind of funny phrase in the middle there, and he's sort of like winking over his glass of sherry or something.
I think this chapter is full of little winks.
So I've got
little asterisks.
You get there in part because as modern science develops, people want to get away from philosophy, theology, sort of the classical tradition. They want something more rational. They want a sort of firmer foundation to justify the existence of natural science. And so they turn to something that looks like more like a science, which is these social sciences. And so the idea is we're going to sort of gather data and we're going to do this kinds of like, you know, sociological analyses, which are going to give the foundation to the natural sciences for them to be able to offer the explanations of natural reality that they have. But as many other scholars have shown, and actually this would be a fun episode now that I'm thinking about it, is just kind of get into some of this. But personally for me, you know, I mean, I think Leo Strauss was very important for me sort of recognizing that this was going on, because initially in his formation intellectually, he was a Weberian. So he was a follower of Weber. And then it was by recognizing this problem, precisely this problem, that he realized, no, I have to go back to ancient philosophy. They're offering something thicker. They're offering a better account of reality that actually can help natural science if natural science would make itself amenable to it. So that, you know, this is not to say one shouldn't study sociology, but, you know, there's sociology and then there's sociology. And some of it is, you know, pre-theoretical and some of it ain't. And if you're going to do sociology, I think you have to admit that sociology is at a fundamental level doing philosophy before it's gathering the data, before it's interpreting the data. You're making philosophical decisions. And that's precisely what O'Donovan's getting at here. He's just sticking the knife in right there and saying, don't tell me you're doing sociology. Admit that your sociology has a philosophical basis and let's talk on those terms. You know, once you get to the ground of metaphysics, he's happy to engage you. But until you admit that, you know, he's just not going to deal with you.
I don't know about that.
Fine.
I mean, I don't know about that.
That was GIF worthy, like Auntie's facial expression and the progression thereof, and then like the text would come up at the bottom. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I just wasn't sure whether he was trying to give like a sort of description of the logical sort of like terminus of this line of thinking, or whether he was making those sorts of substantive claims about his own position.
I think he is. That's why he says to a moral theologian, right? I mean, it's all the same. It's the same.
Well, but
paragraph.
Same
paragraph.
It's a really long paragraph. It's a long paragraph that runs
should,
over
should
page
set some Straussian alarm bells ringing if there's a really long paragraph.
See what he's really okay. saying, Anzi.
Yeah. I mean, no. You totally could be right. I didn't take it that way.
I think
he was trying to argue that it bottoms out in will. Like if you adopt the sort of sociological frame, when the natural sciences lose confidence, they turn to the social sciences because when the natural sciences realize that there is no such thing as pure observation, right? And there are a variety of ways that natural sciences have realized this, including, you know, contemporary physics, which, you know, recognizes that things being observed changes the things that are under observation. So there's no such thing as pure observation. And so they turn to the social scientists. But then he thinks that this somehow means that he thinks that this is an admission on the part of the hard science, the people who do hard science, that that their work depends on the construal that society imposes. So their turn to the social scientists is a turn to is an admission that their work is only sort of possible insofar as it's licensed and approved by society.
Empiricism like requires an account, and it cannot
right.
provide
and that
itself
account
one.
Is
it
socially
can't be empirical.
Determined.
Yeah.
Right, and that account is socially determined.
Well, it's determined in some way, and natural science in modernity has turned to the social to give it that.
Right, no, right.
And he's contesting that on other grounds.
Well, he doesn't get to the contestation yet. He just says then the logical endpoint of this is that it is manifestly clear. Oh, well, here's what he says. And what is the meaning of this social construal other than the imposition of society's projects and purposes upon the way reality is understood, which is to say the conversion of science into technique? It is manifestly clear how this is the case with the argument we are now considering, for it is our will to determine people's sex by assigning and reassigning them, which is used as proof that this is how people's sex is actually determined.
Yeah, he's just metaphysicsing sociology.
How do you mean?
It's a, he's saying, what's at the basis of your sociological account? It's will.
Let
how
the
did
record
get there?
Show that it's now okay. Reese who's no, he's saying that that's their position.
Yes.
For it is will to determine people's sex.
But
right.
That's not what sociologists would say. This is my point. This is exactly what he's been saying the whole time. He's going to give us an interpretation of what it means and what's happened there. You ask the sociologists what's going on here. They don't just, I mean, most of them, the smart ones are going to admit it's just will. But most of them are not going to say that. They're going to give you some account. They're going to give
you
statistics.
They're going to say, well, some people are out there imposing their will on stuff, and that's a problem. But the rest of us are just here,
right.
You know, cultivating and helping people realize themselves.
Yeah, we're trying to make
then,
a good
like,
society.
So helping
we're
them
trying to be
impose their will. So, yeah, I think he's making a critique of the social sciences that they wouldn't entirely recognize. And I think his thing of science and technique, we convert science into technique. He's discussed technique much earlier and just... root of those words, you know, scientia, wisdom is to know things, just receive as is, technique is to go and do and impose and put your will onto stuff.
Okay. I'm still not quite satisfied with this, but we should move on. My hang-ups should not determine.
Let me make one more attempt.
The shape of this podcast episode.
Let's put the book down and try to work through the argument. Can we do that? Just like 1 second. So I think
Colin's imposing his techne.
I'm gonna do some techne here.
Your Aristotelian dark arts. All right, Colin, let's do it. Right,
I think what he's getting at is that you have to give an account of what's going on if it's going to all be socially constructed, and the account that the interpretation he wants to give it is to say what we're admitting is that it's just about will, but that's not what the sociologists would say.
But isn't that precisely what the sort of like, I mean, I'm not super familiar with Judith Butler and her work, but isn't that sort of precisely what she would say, right? Is that there's a social will and it's patriarchal that has
wants
determined
one thing.
That certain people should be assigned a certain way and other people should be assigned another. I mean, isn't that sort of, that's how I took him. I took him to be sort of like saying that sociologists will say that there's a kind of collective will that makes these determinations. And then the sort of next step that they would make would be to say that it's not licensed to make those determinations. That, you know, once you overthrow the power of the...
But I
don't know. But that's how I take it. Does that make sense?
I think he's talking about social sciences who will kind of affirm the movement of transsexualism. And I think it's there that he thinks they would certainly not say that someone transitioning sex is imposing their will in the same way as the nasty people who imposed sex on them in the first place.
Yeah, I was talking about the initial assignment.
I think he's talking about the reassigning being an exertion of will.
Yeah, he's talking about the sociologists that the natural scientists turn to.
Well, he says by assigning and reassigning them.
Yeah.
So he's talking about the whole process. To organically push us on, I think this is then where he gets to on page 30, where he says it just bottoms out, and this is just society in conflict with itself.
Yeah.
When this happens. So
always reading context would have saved Colin 5 minutes
of
exasperation.
Page 30, nearest the top, towards the middle. No, the problem is that there is a conflict between the status that society conceives itself to have conferred and the status that it has actually conferred. The problem is a clash between the perceptions which society has of this person and the perceptions which society, by some means or other, has given her to have of herself. Therefore, the social construction of reality is at war with itself, and there is a resolution of the conflict to be made. So, society has imposed one thing, it thinks it has imposed another thing.
I think this is still all the
then the other person wants to push their will up against it.
No, I still think this is all the description. He's giving an account of how, on the psychological case, this sort of contradiction is to be understood from within the framework of the people who think that who make the sort of fundamental.
But if it's all will, why does it have to be a reason to count?
Well, here's what he says. So he says, the problem. So what's the problem? The problem is not that the patient has failed to come to terms with the reality for female physiology, for we cannot speak of her female physiology as more real than her male gender identity, which is the product of social forces. So there we're clearly talking about these constructivist accounts, right? Because the physiology is not more real than the gender identity. But the problem is not that the patient has failed to come to terms with reality on this account. No, the problem is that there's a conflict between the status that society conceives itself to have conferred, which is to say assigned female at birth, and the status it has actually conferred, which is feeling male and therefore being truly male. And the problem is a clash between the perceptions which society has of this person, namely that she's female because she was assigned female at birth, and the perceptions which society, by some means or other, has given her to have of herself, namely that she's truly male. Therefore, the social construction of reality is at war with itself, and there is a resolution of the conflict to be made. A reconstruction of reality has to be undertaken around the feelings of the patient. Her or his feelings of resentment and dissatisfaction are the point at which society has to encounter the contradiction in what it has done. So that is, I think, all within the frame of people who have made the sort of moves at the outset of this description, which we've been talking about on the podcast episode, collapsing the psychological and the sexual. So you have a psychosexual unity, which is socially constructed. And he's saying that once, on the account of people who do this, who think this way, there's a conflict because society thinks it's assigned this person female, but actually she feels like she's male, and society has caused that too. So you have society at war with itself, and the way that on this theory society resolves this conflict is by reassigning her from what it thought she was to what it actually made her, reassigning her from female to male.
I don't disagree with the fact that he's, I mean, everything you said is fine and I agree with it, but I don't think that you are understanding the point that I'm making.
Oh, maybe not. That was a response to Reese.
Oh, okay. I don't think even what you're saying is in disagreement with what Reese was saying, at least not on my understanding, but maybe I wasn't listening, you know, closely enough.
When I thought Reese was saying that this was him making his substantive critique. And I'm saying, no, he's still describing.
No, but he is making, okay, here's.
But he concludes this section by saying that transsexual surgery is a humorous reductio ad absurdum of sociological theories of reality.
Yes, so, that's right. And yeah, but so
that's like 20 sentences later.
Same paragraph.
Here's one paragraph, my friend.
Same paragraph.
This
is actually the second paragraph from the long one.
Do you know where paragraph breaks were introduced?
No, this is the second paragraph in a row that you have said this paragraph is too long. Take it up with the author. I would say I don't think that it addresses the substantive point that I'm making, which is you've got a boy, right, Anzi?
Yes.
Does he do things?
He does, in fact, do things.
Okay, and nice. If you ask him, why'd you do that, does he give you some sort of account?
Yeah, normally it's my Nora took that, and I want it.
Can you give a better account than he can?
He's kind of pure appetite at this point, so maybe not.
Bingo. Well, I disagree. I think even there, you saying he's pure appetite is you giving a more reasoned account than his account. So, in other words, if it's just will, then you don't need a reasoned account necessarily, but a reasonable person who believes in reason, not in will, can give a better account of the person who's acting purely out of will. That's what he's doing here. So, in other words, I agree with you. He's speaking from the perspective, right? He's giving this descriptive account, but it's a reasoned account. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when he hits this point at which the reasoning becomes impossible because it hits a wall inside of itself, that's where he says, we just have to admit this is a reductio ad absurdum. It doesn't work. You can't give a coherent description of reality this way. I've tried, no matter how hard you try, it will not cash out into something reasonable. And therefore, if your primary interest is reason, i.e. this philosophical construction of reality, which could come to the aid, come to a better aid of the natural sciences, you have to ditch this social construction theory whole hog and move to some other way of thinking, which might actually, in the end, recover the sociological.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's true, actually. My point was just to say, was to try to distinguish where he's just describing and pushing and where the sort of reductio comes in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The reductio comes in towards the end of that paragraph, but he's so setting it up the whole time.
You know, yes, obviously. That's
by because every forcing them to be reasonable.
Every argument that ends with a reductio is setting up the reductio the whole time.
Right. But again, this is why the, you know, people who would dislike this form of interaction are going to say things like reason itself might be problematic. You know, reason is the problem right here. And that's part of the sociological account that he's contrasting himself with. And saying,
so I guess I grant that you might be that I grant that your description of what he's doing. So he obviously intends a reductio because he says he does. But I think your stuff about the reasonable account versus the account that's based on will is a really interesting observation of what's happening. I just don't know that that's what he's intending to say in this. Does that make sense?
I disagree. It's all about Aristotle, Anzi.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Strauss, like he's sort of modeling with the. But yeah, but no, I mean, I think that's a. Whether I'm right or not, and I'm probably wrong, it's a remarkable observation, I think, actually, that the person who gives the reason account, but you're doing so on reason's own terms, which is why that, as you point out, the many of the theorists with, you know, contemporary theorists, at least, would then sort of reject that reason has the kind of authority that people are granting it in arguments like these.
But which as Christians, and so this is just to sort of, for the Christian audience out there, tie this together, you know, Christians are not allowed to abandon reason entirely. So we can say that reason has a place, that human reason is fallen, that it has certain limits beyond which it shouldn't transgress. But you can't be a pure advocate of unreasonableness. You can't say that reason has no place in nature or in reality, because it's right there in John 1, right? And the account is that Jesus is the truth, and truth requires a certain account, that there's an account which is consistent with itself inside of the truth. And so, you know, as a moral theologian, you know, highlight those words, you're doing a distinct kind of thing. And if you want to recover sociology, you have to be able to do it from the perspective of moral theology.
Yeah, I buy that. It's kind of a nice radical orthodoxy move.
Oh, no. I don't like it anymore. I abandoned it. I rejected it.
But I mean, right, the only true sociology can be recovered from within Christian orthodoxy. I mean, that's like a
classic. It's the queen of the sciences, you know?
Yeah, that's a...
Are we going to try and cover the social case very quickly? This has all been the psychological case.
I don't think we have time.
The pages from the end.
I don't either.
No, we got four or three pages. That was great. That was great.
Listeners, I'm sorry we failed you.
What are you reading? Besides Begotten or Made.
Besides Begotten or Made, what am I reading? I'm reading... I was reading Hegel last week for one of my classes. So Hegel, what is it? Like essays on introducing like the philosophy of history or something. Really, really fascinating. I may write a paper, like a term paper about Hegel, but yeah, just really interesting stuff. He has this whole theory that like you can't have true history until you have a state, because the state produces the conditions that are required for subjective understanding of events.
Because you need contrasting accounts or something.
Yeah, basically his argument is that the state has laws. The state is the first thing that has sort of fixed standards and metrics and values that sort of generate a recognition that people can act in accordance with these or not. And then it leaves records of these metrics or values. And it records like events in accordance with these metrics or values. And so that produces history or something. I mean, that's kind of I sort of probably did violence to his argument, but it's something like that. It was completely unconvincing, super fascinating. It was a lot of fun to read. So, yeah. Anyway, Colin, how about you?
I was just teaching Rousseau's Social Contract. And, you know, very, very intrigued in this junior seminar. We get to contrast it with Hobbes. We used to contrast it with both Locke and Hobbes, and that was even more fun. But even just getting Rousseau and Hobbes sort of back-to-back weeks, you have this very, you know, rich conception of the variety and the stakes of what can be meant by nature and therefore natural law. And so it's a healthy reminder and caution to me as well as to any listener who wants to sort of reach for natural laws and explanation for you know, behaviors or policies or social or moral norms. You know, natural law was first given to us, I believe, in the mouth of one of the sophists inside of Plato. Was it Gorgias? I can't remember exactly.
I think so. It's something I've studied with you. And
Callicles. I think it's Callicles from the Gorgias. I mean, you know, and in
particular, is Callicles the proto-Nietzschean? Mm-hmm. I mean, right, because he thinks natural law is the rule of the mighty.
But, you know, Rousseau is actually a kind of genius because he does not route. He doesn't think nature is red in tooth and claw. He thinks that the point of the social contract is everybody is sort of so mortally afraid of being owned on Twitter. You know, he thinks looking bad in front of other people, having everyone look down on you, is the actual worst thing. Death is not as bad because at least you don't exist anymore.
Not the Hobbesian state of nature where it's just
anarchy. What's really bad, because you're a rational creature, isn't death. It's having to live while people think that you're stupid. Pathetic. Yeah, exactly. Looking stupid next to somebody who looks smart. So the social contract is a sort of a way of making sure that I don't have to be any subservient to anybody in particular, because we all have to enter into this sucker together.
Even if they're smarter than I am.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And they're not, in a certain sense, because I got them to sign on for the social contract too. And so, you know, I showed them.
That's true.
It's a brilliant insight. How about you, Reese?
I am reading a book called God's Clockmaker. It's a book I've actually wanted to read for a couple of years, but it's been super expensive whenever I've looked at it. It's like a big kind of academic-ish hardback thing. It's usually like 50 to 65 quid on Amazon. And then I saw it on ABE Books for like £25, good as new, secondhand library copy. It's like, bang, let me get that. I mentioned a book, it was my summer reading a while back, called The Light Ages, which is kind of an account of medieval science and medieval astronomy. It was very popular a couple of years ago. Richard of Wallingford is one of the guys mentioned in this book. He's the abbot of St. Albans Priory in the 1300s. He's a super cool guy. He's a son of a blacksmith. His father then dies when he's about 10. He's adopted by monks and enters eventually into St. Albans Priory, and he's a super genius, and he creates probably one of the most advanced clocks in the world in the 1300s. But a clock in the 1300s isn't just a clock. It tells you the movements of the stars, the position of the tide at London Bridge, true solar time, equal and unequal hours, which are all real things. So it's a super cool life. Like, you know, he's raised up to the age of 10 and his dad's smithy. And so there probably gets this kind of mechanical mind and like beating iron. And then he goes to the monks and they realize he's really clever. So they send him to Oxford, and then he gets kind of mathematics and astronomy and that kind of thing. And then he becomes the abbot of St. Albans and also has to deal with all the kind of moral reform that his monks need, because his monks are just kind of going around like, you know, getting women pregnant and stuff like that. There's a story of Queen came to visit St. Albans while he was the abbot, and all the women of the village were holding up their babies, who were the bastard children of the monks, to the Queen, to be like, give us justice, you know, from these rapacious monks. But the Queen didn't speak English, because she was Jenny, spoke French, and so she thought they were all asking her to like bless the children. And so Richard's dealing with that. And then he gets like some kind of skin disease that's basically leprosy, and is just kind of tinkering away on his clock, dealing with this degenerative disease, trying to reform his monks. Super cool guy.
Bad, sad ending though.
Well, no, I don't think he dies of the disease.
You know, that's not so good either. Then I'm just saying, once you get leprosy back then,
it better at least kill you. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, things aren't looking up at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. On that note, Reese, what's our spotlight today?
Our spotlight is, because this is recorded a fair bit in advance, our spotlight is just going to be highlighting the most recent print issue of Adfontes, which should be with you by the time this comes out, or very much around about this time. Our Spring 23 issue, it has an all-star lineup featuring no less than our very own Auntie Camel, with an essay in there. I'm very glad to have Auntie writing something. Thanks, for us. That's okay, pleasure. We have contributions as well from Jacob Honeycutt, writing about Fanny Crosby's hymns. Robert Strivens, who's a fellow countryman of mine, writing about reformed anti-confessionalism. Tim Perry, writing a piece about the Virgin Mary in the Reformed Confessions. And our reviews, we've got our president, Brad Littlejohn, with his regular review. Ephraim Radner, big name, big name, reviewing Rusty Reno's new book, another big name, some Anglican, Catholic beef, but beef among friends, because they're friends. And Eric Hutchinson, one of our bloggers, and doing a double review of a recent book about Bob Dylan and a recent book by Bob Dylan. Hutch is a big Dylan fan.
I'm really stoked for that one. Yeah. I'm really excited for everything Eric writes. Just fantastic.
And yeah, I had to like make sure another pair of eyes went on that review, because I was just super excited when it came in and was just like, oh, this is great. This is great. This is great. So made sure someone else had a look at it.
Yeah.
So you go, and you need to subscribe to be able to access it. So if it's out already, it'll be too late for you to get that print edition in the mail. But you can go and get a digital subscription or a digital and print subscription, so that you make sure you get the Summer 23 edition falling through your letterbox.
That's great. Awesome. Well, if you like what you heard today on the podcast, go subscribe.
Yes.
Give us your money. I don't care about 5-star reviews for this one episode. Just give us your hard-earned cash. Subscribe to the print magazine, ideally. But if they didn't like it, Colin, what should they do?
If you didn't like this episode, you need to move out here to sunny California, and you need to start a tech company. You need to grow that tech company. You need to be working insane hours. You need to be networking insane hours. You need to be meeting other founders of tech companies. You need to be joining group chats with other founders of tech companies. And then when your company has a sizable bank account built up with a local regional bank that you know and love, you need to suddenly tell everybody, I don't think there's any money left in this bank. Then take your money out, donate it to the Diamond Institute, but then you can give us a 1-star review once you've given us the money. And then cause a run on the bank, collapse the Western financial system. And if you do that, we promise we'll use that money responsibly and make sure there's space for you at a retreat location, which we will disclose at a later point.
I love it. In fact, I promise that if you hate this podcast enough that you're willing to do that, we'll shut it down. Just give us all that money, we'll stop podcasting.
Thing is, we're recording this at the end of March. We have no idea how the world's going to look by the time that this comes out.
Awesome. All right. Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure as always. And with that, we are the editors. This is the Adfontes podcast, and we will see you next time.